Edite.
So, Editha, could you begin by telling us about your family before the war, your family life?
Well, we lived in Warsaw in up to 1937 in a fairly Jewish part of Warsaw, sort of quite a nice big building, but definitely surrounded by other, I would say, middle class Jewish families. My father was an engineer that specialized in lights, and all the sort of colorful lights in Warsaw in front of the cafes and restaurant, neon lights. This was the first sort of neons that came in Warsaw in multicolors, and I think this was his specialty. His name was Ignacy Klein. My mother was a typical Warsaw, fairly well-to-do woman. Her parents, my grandfather, his name was Jakub Krysławin, owned three pharmacies in Warsaw. Two were sort of smallish in Jewish parts of the town. One was on the left bank and rather a large corner shop. So she had the sort of, financial security from her husband and her father. I was brought up by nannies, which I don't remember very much, but by a governess from the age of five. Also, she was Jewish. She was intelligent and fantastic, and she opened my mind and my life and the way of looking at people. Fortunately, she was in 42. She was one of the first victims. She was taken to Treblinka, and so life was. I had no all my schooling at home, organized by that governess who taught me herself and brought tutors if necessary. I think this was partly because mother did not want to send me to Jewish school, and she was afraid of enough anti-Semitism to send me to a non-Jewish school that would be on a level. So consequently, every 6 months I had to pass exams until the war started, and the war started, I was 10. And in 1939, finally, before the war, she was forced to put me to school. And so I started in 39, early October, when the Germans were already in this quite a lovely school. It was named after the Polish marshal, and all the children were from some better homes, but definitely very Catholic. I was the only Jew in the whole school. And by the end of October 39, the announcement came that the Jewish children are not allowed any education, and after a few weeks my formal education have ended, which I must say I was not sorry at all, because it was not a comfortable experience.
Were you an only child?
Yes, I was the only child.
Did you have any particular hobbies or activities that you enjoyed?
Yes, I was a very good chess player. I had my lovely bicycle. I had a playmate, a boy my age, who came every afternoon, and my governess looked after him just so I could have a playmate. We had a little villa outside of Warsaw, sort of. Now, when I went to look for it, I couldn't even find it. But it was only a few kilometers out of Warsaw, and we would spend part of the summers. We spent every summer practically in Sopot on the sea, and that's where that little photo that you took is taken, on that, in that place. And, you know, the life, people sort of, we closed, I think my family sort of closed themselves off, that whatever happens, they will survive. And they shot the anti-Semitism out. There certainly was always, and this was the reason why I was not sent to school, that such anti-Semitism existed.
Did you have any personal experience of anti-Semitism?
I didn't hear.
Did you have any personal experience of anti-Semitism as a child?
I think so. You know, it was there, and I knew I was never allowed to even put a foot outside our front door without my governess or grown up to protect me just in case. Yes, the children would sometimes shout, and it was, you know, a Jew or dirty Jew or whatever, but it was also envy. I had a beautiful bicycle, and just before the war I had a beautiful dog, a Great Dane, which are paraded up and down. So obviously that sort of also caused some envy.
You know. You talked about visiting your grandmother's grave in the cemetery as a family outing. Could you describe those outings for us?
Shall I describe the cemetery?
Did your grandmother die? When did your grandmother
die? My grandmother died in 37, and in May 37. But before she died, she was already quite fragile and sick in 36. That's when we moved from our apartment in Warsaw on Leszno Street to a large apartment on the left bank. And my grandparents lived there because this was in the vicinity of that large, the largest pharmacies that they owned. And they spent, my grandfather spent most of his time in that particular pharmacy. So we moved there, and that's where the war caught us. We lived in, it was called Praga, left bank, and that's where the school was that I tried it out for a few weeks. And grandmother died in 37, and we stayed with my grandfather, and my young uncle, my mother's much younger brother, lived at home. And so I mentioned at that cemetery because my mother was adored her mother, and I adored my grandmother, that we went there sort of almost every Sunday to until the war started to visit the grave.
You said you were very much a city girl and your mother was a city woman. So what do you remember of Warsaw? And did you go to cafes? And
yes. You know, I went to, she would take me sometimes for the afternoon dances were called in Polish 5 o'clock. So she took me to the 5 o'clocks sometimes, and I loved music and had beautiful little velvet dresses with big bows in my hair. And I loved the park, I loved the zoo. On Sunday one went from one patisserie to another because this one had very good eclairs, the other one specialized in cheesecake. So you always sort of walked in a city, and we were just used to it. And this little villa we had in the country, I spent a few days, a couple of months out of the year there, but it never made a great impression on me. I never was sort of in love with the countryside. I remember keeping a pet rooster, which I know my parents, but I really don't have sort of strong memories of there.
Did you ever go further afield for your holidays from the country villa?
Just before the war in 1939, I really don't know why, my mother sent me towards the east of Poland on the Bug River. There was a beautiful resort with a lovely little pension, and she sent me there with my governess in August, for the month of August. And I remember the horror of coming back, because she managed to get through on the telephone and told the governess to just get everything and get me and try to get on the nearest train possible and get back to Warsaw. And I had the bicycle with me, which was my such proud possession. And we couldn't get on a train. The trains were full of soldiers and was complete pandemonium. And I remember hours on that little, can't remember the name of the village, waiting there with her. And she was a little woman, and she was really sort of handicapped. She had not really a hunchback, but almost. And she was energetic enough, and she finally got us on a train and a bicycle. So this was by the end of August 39. It really was, people knew that it's going to happen any minute, any day, and it did.
What are your first recollections of seeing Germans in Warsaw?
I think even before the Germans, this was, the bombs started falling even before the official announcements on the radio, and you heard the artillery and so on. And then the mayor of Warsaw announced on the radio that for all the men, it had nothing to do with Poles and Jews, he didn't mention who, he said all the men should go that are not in uniform and fighting and don't have their orders should go east. And we as a family, they all decided not to split up. And we, mother and I, went by that time, my stepfather, my grandfather, my uncle, and mother and I, and we walked east and dragged our suitcases and possessions and so on. I was only 10 years old. I wasn't a great walker. My grandfather was pushing 70, which by that time it was, considered old. And we walked maybe 30 kilometers and stayed for a night. And the family decision was to walk back, to go back to Warsaw. And, of course, thousands of people walked at that time, walked east, got through where the Russians were. And the main Jews that have survived the Holocaust are the Jews that survived Siberia and Russian camps and Well, on that side, very few survived any other way. But we unfortunately, again, there were so many food supplies in our apartment, and still comfort, and still the Polish servants, two servants were home watching it all. So we went back. And by the time we got back, must have been the 9th, 10th of September. So, of course, the water was cut off, you saw dead horses on the street, the bombs, you know, fighting. The Polish artillery, unfortunately, was almost not existent. We lived very near the zoo, and they had the artillery set up in the zoo. And you saw for a couple of days wild animals, you know, tigers and monkeys and so on, you know, glimpsing on the streets. It was sort of my first sense of horror. And they just marched in by the... In a few weeks, I think, by the time the end of September.
How did things change for you and your family after that?
It changed almost immediately, because first they wanted the Germans to restore some sort of order, cleaning units and so on. So the first thing was that they would take the Jewish men to clean the rubble, to scrub the streets, to tidy up. And the better dressed the person looked to them, you know, the harder the work. Within a few weeks we had to... Every Jew, male or female, over the age of 12, had to wear an armband, a white with the blue Star of David. It had to be a certain width and always clean and sort of prominently display on the right arm, so they had no difficulties of, you know, recognizing the Jew on the street when they wanted one. This gave me freedom, because I wasn't 12 years old, so I could still sort of, you know, go out on the street. I still had my dog, which of course we had to give up very soon after that, just simply the logistics of feeding a big animal. Food was disappearing. And as I said, that my school education lasted only a few weeks. Jewish children were not allowed schooling. And this sort of my stepfather was caught on a street for work. And at that time he was such a well-dressed man, he was afraid to wear the type of hats, sort of like Anthony Eden type, that he was wearing. So he was wearing a beret, and he didn't take off the beret fast enough in front of the German, and they beat him up, so they broke his nose, you know, and so on, because every male Jew had to take off a hat in front of a German, even if the German was a soldier, 19 years old. And in this sort of way, we survived until 1940. And of course, by that time, the food conditions for everyone were getting more and more difficult. And my governess had to go to her family to sort of help them. And we were still well enough that mother hired a young Polish girl to look after me and and take me for walks. There was never a question of letting me out on my own, probably because, not just because of the Germans, but because of the anti-Semitism. And also it started that Jewish flats were permanently raided by the Germans. They would find out, which was very easy because everybody in Poland, in whole of Poland, was registered, which were the Jewish flats in the building, and would come daily and just take away what they wanted. And this was practically, we were within a few months left with, with bedding, because they were afraid of any contamination, so they didn't touch the bedding. And it was more and more difficult, and definitely talks about the ghetto. But people were optimistic. They couldn't understand how such a big town and so many Jews, how they're going to put them in one place. And then May, we had a very freak snowstorm in Warsaw, and the snow fell about quite high on the streets. And my grandfather was coming from the pharmacy home before the curfew. Of course, there was a curfew. And young soldiers sort of jumped him and stuck him in the snow. Of course, they could see that he had his armband with the Star of David, and put him in the snow and danced around him for hours on end. He came home and caught pneumonia, and he died within 10 days. So we lost him in May. And this sort of came, you know, I think was a tremendous shock to us. And also they were telling us that we can't keep that pharmacy for long. And the rumor of the ghetto started, and we could see the wall being built. Yes?
No, I'd like you to describe seeing the wall being built.
And finally the date of November 12th came as the date to that we have to move into the walls that were by that time will be finished. As I mentioned, there was, in a way of furniture, there was not that much for paintings or anything of value. It was not that much to worry about. The fairs and anything with the fair, including even the children's fair slippers, we had to give up before that. And so really when people were into the ghetto, it was horrid with push carts, with, carried bags. And how do you get in there? We were four people by that time. And we were very fortunate through some friends to secure a room in what was once a lovely flat. And it was overlooking. The wall was built right in the middle of the road. So one side was ghetto side, the other side was a beautiful park. And it was the proper Warsaw side. And we had what was a living room in this flat. So I could look out through the window and see children playing, sort of well-fed and seemed carefree, and here we were closed in a ghetto. But we stayed in that room for 20 months. It was our our living room, our bedroom, our bathroom, our loo, my schoolroom. Everything was in that room until July 42. And, you know, you can get used to anything. Of course, first of all, the hunger started. I remember being continuously hungry. And that sort of started in end of 1940, early 41, when the supplies were difficult to get. But parents organized their children. We were organized in groups of four or five and had wonderful Jewish tutors and teachers who tried to give us as normal education as possible. It was not allowed. Any kind of schooling or books were not allowed. But we would change places, maybe 2 days in our room, 2-3 days in somebody else's. And so we felt we will survive, and we come out, and we need the education, and you know, to have some sort of a start in life. By 41, especially summer 41, you know, life became more of a routine. In the ghetto, we have our minimum ration cards. The food was smuggled by children, by young teenagers from outside, from the Aryan side, into the ghetto. The kids were shot, they were beaten, the food was taken away, but something always trickled in. It became very expensive, so the people that had the bits of jewelry or money saved could eat a little bit. The others, there were more beggars, more people dying. But we had our own government, we had our own police, we had our own orphanages, hospital, horse-drawn streetcars, bicycle rickshaws. So the life was still, you know, the little shops and little trade, and it, horrible as it was some sort of a routine.
What other efforts did your parents and other adults make to keep some kind of Jewish cultural and religious life going in the ghetto?
Yes, would you believe it? We had, as a child, I have never seen a dish called chulent. It's something of potatoes and barley and, you know, and whatever meats that goes in the oven Fridays, so you don't need to cook it or light anything. It comes out on Saturday. And, of course, people didn't have the ingredients, and we always sort of, you know, I always had nightmares that probably a cat or a dog was there in that pot with whatever potatoes. But we sort of learned about it, and people had, people were praying, and we were always very assimilated, you know, and we never had any religious observance, so I don't really... We didn't do it before the war. We didn't do it in a ghetto, but it certainly existed. As far as I was concerned, my tutors and my teaching also was in Polish, and they tried to teach me the beginnings of Latin or English or French, but we, you know, I was not. Unfortunately, I was not brought up in a traditional home.
Did you-